Welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 28th, 1995. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Don Johnson, and his subject, Living Water, Baptism in the Early Church. Let's listen in.
I'm a parish pastor in Vancouver, and I've been on the chairperson of a team dealing with the adult catechumenate in our church, which is a way of bringing adults to baptism. In fact, it happened to me a long time ago that I was at a worship conference in Minneapolis, and it was one of those big worship conferences where you went from worship event then to workshop to workshop to workshop, and finally your mind just gets so filled that you can hardly take anymore. And I was tired, and my hotel room was quite a ways away. So I said, I'm just going to find some place where I can sit down. Oh, here's a room. There's a workshop going on, but I'll sit in the back, and I will just sleep. There was a guy named Mark Searle, who came from Notre Dame University, who was talking about adult catechumenate. And I found myself being drawn in. So rather than sleeping, I kind of got excited about this. And I said to myself, this is something that we need to have happen in the life of our church. So I started to do some things in adult catechumenate in campus ministry in the last years of my campus ministry days, and then I moved to a parish, and it got a little difficult. People didn't understand, but I kept talking to other people about this. So finally, our national church had a fundraising campaign. We were going to raise $5 million to help the national church and so on. And I was on a board at that time, and the board was saying, well, you know, we need to get a hold of some of this money. So I said to the board, well, why don't we ask for some money to develop an adult catechumenate program in our church? They said, what is it? I told them what it was. And they said, oh, that sounds good to us. Let's put it in. I had no hope at all that it would ever be accepted. It was just sort of another way to get the thing in the grill and so on. And lo and behold, they ended up giving us $100,000. The reason they gave it to us is they said they had to be fair to all of the divisions of the church. I'm sure that the people who gave us the money had absolutely no clue at all what this was going to be used for. But they just gave it to us. And so then we sort of said, well, what in the world are we going to do with it now? Now that we got the money, we got to do the program, which was kind of a wonderful thing. So we went to the Lutheran Church ELCA and said, are you interested? And there was a guy named Jan Womer, I think his name was, who was in charge of worship at that time. Yes, he was interested. In fact, he was cooperating with the Episcopalians and said, yeah, we're going to do this adult catechumenate program in our national church along with the Episcopalians. We went to the Anglican Church of Canada, and they said, yeah, we're somewhat interested. Well, the history happened is that Jan Womer got fired from the worship desk in the ELCA. The new people came, and they weren't interested. The Anglican Church backed out on us and said, no, they weren't ready yet. And so it left us the only group that we could possibly cooperate with were the Episcopalians in the United States. The Episcopalians in the United States have been shutting down smaller congregations and have been turning everything into larger parishes. But we are faced in the Canadian church with just an enormous amount of small parishes. So we said, no, I don't think that the program of the Episcopalians is going to really help us. The other thing that happened is that the Episcopalians they're wonderful people. I love them a lot. Their primary interest is in liturgic and worship, and that's the center part of their life. And we said, no, unless we do something with that also includes some kind of doctrinal stuff in this, we're sure that it's not going to be bought by the church in Canada. So finally, we ended up saying, okay, there's nobody out there to cooperate with. The ELCA is out. They're not interested. Although there were individuals interested, but not the church at large. The Anglicans were out, and the Episcopalians, we kind of said, no, we're not sure we want to deal with those people. We're kind of small fish in terms of that group. So we said, let's do it on our own. So we began to develop a program of bringing adults to baptism. And it's kind of fun to have you here this week, because I know that some of the stuff that you do in Crossways...
Crossings. Crossways is a competitive group.
Okay, no, Crossings. That you do in Crossings is precisely some of the stuff that we've also been interested in terms of adult catechumenate. And so we have now finally launched the program. Everything that we prepared as a beginning point is now ready, except for two training videos, which we are still in process of doing. I brought some runs off of the tapes with me to hold in here. They're not complete, but they at least could give you a clue about some of the videos that we're trying to produce that are intended to be helpful to congregations or to individuals who are interested in adult catechumenate. The other thing that we discovered is that as we began to work in this program, we said it is for the newly baptized adults. That's what the program was geared for. And because I live in Vancouver, and in the place that I live, 4% of the population belongs to the church. That's any church, synagogue, 4%.
One, two, three, four.
We said, our church, the whole church, has to start and change its program. I mean, we as Lutherans, at least, if you're a Lutheran, we've been accustomed to living off of the nurture of the past. And so that child baptism, confirmation, transferring of memberships from one congregation to the other, which I sometimes say is nothing more than sheep stealing or sheep borrowing or whatever, you know. But it's sort of like we're living on the tradition of the past, but we do not have a program or a process whereby we're really going to face what's out there in the rest of the world. And what's out there in the rest of the world is a whole group of people who know absolutely nothing about Christendom. I mean, you and I can argue law gospel stuff all we want, but you know, they don't know. They have no background. A friend of mine teaches in the university, and much of English literature is based on biblical tradition. And so he was teaching this book, I don't remember the name of the book, and people said, who are Mary? Who is Joseph? I had a marriage, and I was doing premarital counseling with a couple and was talking to them about the church and about whether they should consider the spiritual life and dimension of their marriage. And the groom said to me, well, before I do that, I have a question. And I said, oh, okay, what's that? What does Christmas mean? I mean, it really shocked me that somehow people would be growing up within our culture and not have anything, not know anything about church. We've made assumptions that people know. And even our programs in the church have made lots of assumptions that people know. Assumptions which we know are wrong. Like our educational programs, that we now have them in terms of bringing adults to baptism, never once really faces the question of how do I pray? We make an assumption that people have grown up with a prayer life and that they know how to pray. Even Jesus' disciples, who had grown up with a religious tradition, a deep religious tradition and deep religious prayer life, asked the question, teach us to pray. But we are growing up with a culture around us that knows absolutely nothing about any of this. So what are we going to do is the kind of question that we need to raise. And what can we as church do in the midst of a what I call very secular culture? And by secular, I mean a culture that does not have God in the agenda whatsoever. So, but baptism has always been an important part of my life. I don't know how it happened to me. I think that I finally read Luther at one point where he said, at a difficult time in his life after he'd been excommunicated, and he was troubled by this, went through depression, and in the midst of the depression, he wrote on the floor of the room where he was staying, "I have been baptized." And in the midst of his depression, walked over and over those words, and then said, in the midst of being excommunicated, in the midst of doing stuff that I never wanted to do, that a new church was being created, stuff that I never wanted, I only wanted to reform the church. In the midst of all of that, even worries about myself and about the direction that we were going, the one thing that I could remember is that God had made a covenant with me in baptism, and God's promise was sure, I have been baptized. All of a sudden, I think in my own life, my own baptism has taken on enormous significance. And so to some extent, I came here also saying, hey, I wish that people also would sort of say, is it possible for us to begin to re-understand something about baptism and about its significance? Because I think that in our churches, baptism has lost some of its significance. At its worst, it becomes a kind of thing to be done.
You have a kid done.
Right. And at its best, it is, or at its, for the most part, I think it is, it remains a kind of cultural act. Or it remains an act of grace, indeed, but an act that then needs to be followed up with born-againism, confirmation, Eucharist, and all of those other kinds of things take on enormous significance, whereas the initial act, which in my estimation is the defining act, and the act which then follows us all the rest of our life, like our birthing does, that kind of significance is lost. I can't remember the guy who's been working on the greenhouse, Brent. I was talking to him the other day. He said, baptism, it's the thing that you have to do. But for me, it's Eucharist that counts. It's Eucharist that counts. So we had a little discussion, and I said, well, no, baptism is equally as significant for me as Eucharist. So last night he was the sponsor of Joe and was very moved by the ceremony. And I went up to him afterwards, and I said, do you think that baptism could maybe grow in your estimation? And he said, you know, there is a possibility. Water is such an important ingredient in both testaments. And it is water that is the saving act. It is out of the water that the whole of creation takes place. It is the water that cleanses the earth and that saves Noah and his family. Going through the Red Sea is the significant act of escape. Going through the water becomes an important act. My understanding is that even before the time of Jesus, that if you were to be converted into the Jewish community, that one of the things that had to happen is that you had to go through the Red Sea. You had to have some kind of cleansing ceremony that took you with your now new ancestors through the Red Sea. So water and baptism has become, is primary. You can think about all the water passages that are in the life of Jesus, eh? And some of them are just wonderful passages. I am one of the I am passages. And then there's that wonderful passage with the woman of Samaria, which is about, you will get something to drink. And once you have tasted this drink, then out of you will flow the living water. And I'm sure that the New Testament people in the first four centuries, when they read these passages, they thought baptism, baptism, baptism. Out of the waters of the bath will come this wonderful new life. It is for them the transforming act. The Apostle Paul in the book of Romans speaks about baptism. And I love that passage from chapter 6, 7, and 8, which is, I think, really baptismal passages. And in those passages, he is talking about the baptized. And then he concludes that whole passage with that wonderful thing about, I am persuaded that neither life nor death, nor principalities nor powers. But he's talking about the baptized. And he's talking about those who've come to these waters of life. Not just about those who have thought about them, but those who have gone through these waters of life are the ones for whom this promise is made known. I once did a tour of a few countries in Africa. It was when in my campus ministry days. And I had a three-month sabbatical, and I said, I'm going to go and find out what indigenization of African liturgy really has amounted to. I was also interested in it because some man had said to me once that the African church is going to teach the rest of the world one thing, and they're going to teach them how to dance at worship. I think maybe that's still true, but when I got to Africa, I discovered that there were lots of people who said, no, dance, that's a part of old culture, and out it goes. But in some places, they couldn't stop it. I remember going to the eastern part of South Africa, to the place where the Norwegians had their mission field. And I went to the worship service on Ascension Day. It was filled, the church was filled. What was surprising to me is that even though I could not understand the language, is that the liturgy I could understand, because it was the liturgy that I had grown up with in a Norwegian community in Saskatchewan. I mean, Norwegians, they hang on to their culture pretty strongly. So that it was, I knew none of the words, but I knew exactly what was taking place in the liturgy. They also had one other thing, namely that they brought their offerings up around the altar on festival days, and this was a festival day. And so here was this really tight community. I mean, everybody doing their P's and Q's and the preacher supposedly talking about the grace of God and yelling at us all the time. But the time came for the offering. And then it was fun to watch the people move because they really gently danced. You couldn't take it away in terms of the movement. That was probably the worst part. When I was in the Cameroon, I heard a story which I think was just blew my mind. And it was the story about a tribe and how they initiate people into the tribe. And I said, and this person told me the story to kind of try to compare it to how Christians baptized. Raised the question about, what's happened to us in our minimalization. In this tribe in the north of the Cameroon, when a child is 12 or 13 years old, it is sent off into the bush. And there is one or two men who go with the children as their teachers. They learn how to do the things of the bush. They also spend time alone. They also learn tribal things. They learn religious life. All of that takes place during this six-month period away from your family, out in the bush. It is a time of deep personal growth where you have to face your fears, for you have to also go out and hunt alone. It is a time when you have to raise the kind of question about who you are and what you are. After all of the celebration and all of the teaching is done, all of the children who are now no longer going to be children, but will now be considered adults in the tribe, are brought back to the tribe. The tribe gathers on one side of the river. The children gather on the other side. They are then dragged through the waters of the river by an adult. And they come up on the bank drowned. They are motionless. And then the head person of the tribe goes and gives them a new name one by one, and they eventually stand up. They are no longer the children of their families. They now are the men of the tribe. You hear about this and you wonder, my goodness, there must have been some Christian person who was wandering around a long, long time ago and had somehow talked to them about coming through the waters. Or maybe there's something universal about the waters. I don't know. The person told me this story, and then he said, do you know how we baptize children in the Lutheran church in the Cameroon? And I said, I could probably guess. He said, we have a little font about this size, and we bring the children forward in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and that's it. He said, when are we going to again be able to catch on and learn again from the traditions of the church or of the traditions of other people, so that this minimalization which has happened in terms of baptism can again grow into something new? So this morning I wanted to simply tell you about what happened in the first three centuries of baptism. And because there was a pattern that was developed, a pattern of bringing new Christians into the church, and it was used throughout the whole of the church. There may have been some differing customs, but that pattern had been developed and was used throughout the whole of the church prior to the coming of Christendom. Prior to the 4th century. And then at the beginning of the 4th century and later on, this program deceased and died for some obvious reasons. Namely, they finally got it all done. They just forced everybody to be baptized and there was nobody left for children to be baptized. So the process changed. I realize also that we are not in the same situation as we were in the first three centuries. We are not under persecution.
Will be.
We aren't. We aren't. Yes, others may be. We are. Not everything in the culture is considered to be heathen. that we as Christians enjoy the friendship and the understanding and of a lot of people who do not name themselves as Christian. And we've come to understand that they are our friends, even though they do not understand the Christ or accept the Christ. But they have an agenda and a program which is often very similar to ours. So that, for example, many people in the ecology movement, even though we may not buy everything that they do, that we do see something in what they are doing as a part of what is the tradition which we also need to rediscover for ourselves. So our situation is not the same. And yet in some ways it is the same. Namely that we live in a culture which whose value system is very strange and foreign to the Christian community. Many of us are caught in the middle. That to some extent we want to accept the value system of the age, and on the other hand we want to deny the value system of the age, and we're kind of caught in the middle. But many of us are again discovering, and we've been in this discovery for, well, maybe throughout all of our age, there's always been people who have said this. I mean, maybe people like St. Francis have always come forward to raise questions about the way we live. But we ourselves, many of us, are raising questions about the way we live and are also seeing that the value system that we have adopted is also a value system that will bring death and destruction. That if you want to talk about the wrath of God, we know that the wrath of God also is demonstrated when those who do not follow the law, who do not follow the good direction that God has for us, walk in other ways, bring about death and destruction. So it's impossible for us to continue to live in a society in which the gladiators are the highest paid people in the land without thinking in terms of Rome. It is impossible for us to think of living in a society where those who have wealth are given advantage to get more wealth, and those who do not have wealth, even that which they have is taken away. It is impossible for us to think about living in a society that values privatization and sees that as its primary motivating factor when we and know something that in the biblical tradition it is community. And one could go on about the secular land. You've heard it many times before. But the kind of question is, what does it now mean for us to bring Christians into the church? Does it mean that somehow we're going to teach them a little bit of Lutheran doctrine without confronting them with the real issues which we know and feel in our hearts and struggle with? Will two sessions before an adult baptism really do that? Will people really begin to hear about the value of the Christian life in four sessions of adult instruction prior to baptism, or 10? So we turn for help to an ancient method. And it is not just we as Lutherans who are beginning now to turn to that ancient method for help, but Roman Catholics have been involved in it for a long time. 25 years in North America, as they have said, there is some help here. So let me tell you the process. A person would hear the gospel through a variety of methods. in the first three centuries. It could be roaming evangelists, for there were many. Association with someone with whom you worked and lived. It could have been a family with which you were associated. But there were ways and methods of people beginning to hear the good news about Jesus. And interest would be piqued. And they would say, perhaps I would like to become a follower of Jesus. It was at that time that they would then be presented to the church and to the church community, and within the church community, but cautiously, as inquirers. And there would be many questions that needed to be asked and answered. A sponsor, often a family, would be given to that person. I think it's fun that that person often would be homeless or amongst the poor and would therefore go and live with the family. So the multitudes of questions would take place around the dinner table and in everyday life. Finally, this person would say, I want to become baptized and to be a follower of Jesus. And it would be at that time that the person was introduced into the larger community and then accepted in a ceremony as a candidate for baptism, like we had last night. The candidate for baptism was then to spend time in the community and with the sponsor, with the scriptures as the main focal point. The candidate would be invited to come to church and to join the community in the scriptural part of the ceremony of Sunday morning or Sundays. And the candidate was then asked to leave at the time of Holy Communion. This was only for those who had been baptized. I think for those who had been baptized. I think it means that even the children who had been baptized were also stayed for the festival of the supper. That's another story. I don't want to get into that one. The candidates were asked to leave. This went on for as long a period of time as was required. And eventually the candidate then said, I am now know that I am ready for baptism. The candidate would be then brought to the congregation, usually focusing about 40 days before the Easter celebration. Because the Easter celebration was the time in which baptisms took place. And 40 days was an important time because it was Jesus in the wilderness for 40 days. And the 40 days of Jesus in the wilderness was of deep significance to them all. Because to thou announce that I am prepared for baptism, the candidate was invited to then go into the wilderness. The wilderness meant for them that three questions had to be asked. One question is, what do I have to give up? What do I have to leave behind? What is there in my life that must be changed and transformed in order for me to be prepared for the bath? The second question was, what does it mean for me to be a believer in Jesus? The third question is, how shall I live out my daily life? What are the patterns of my life that need to change? During those 40 days, The candidate was brought to the congregation three times. One time, it was given the creed. These are called the scrutinies, if you're interested in the technical term. Another time, there was exorcism. I think exorcism is a wonderful thing that we ought to consider again. If I might pause just a little bit. You see, what we do in our society is that we have privatized exorcism and have turned it over to the psychiatrists and the psychologists. And we in the church have given up on it because we think that it is not the strength of the community that will help people to get rid of whatever it is that is in their life that is not worthy of the bath. We've said, no, it has to be done in private counseling. The other thing that's happened to us is that most of us have, I mean, there's just all kinds of weird exorcism stuff happening in amongst fundamentalist churches, or most of us saw the Exorcist movie, and it just has turned us all off from the Word. And so it's very hard to redo that Word again and to bring that Word back into the life of the church again. I'm not sure myself what to do with it, and so I don't do it. But I still have this kind of inner feeling that what's wrong with our, what's wrong even with the healing and helping professions is that it is often done outside the context of a community. And that what we need to do is not to say, no, they're no good, but what we often need to do is to bring back some of that healing within the life of the community again.
But doesn't the community first have to be healthy? And how many? It has to be at least confident of where its health comes from.
Oh, of course.
So you also have to have exemplary people, because what I find in the congregations that I've been in is that there are people who are seen as exemplary people to whom others will turn, and frequently it's not me, the pastor, it's other people in the congregation that they will go to, and I've tried to use those people as the people to forgive sins, for example, in the Maundy Thursday liturgy, the ones who lay their hands on. You know, I know that the congregation has invested me with that power, as it were, but they have also made me into the chief administrator and the one who has to say yes and no around financial issues. So I lose the power around health, because I'm given these other things that I have to deal with. Now, how do you find a community that knows its center and health in Jesus Christ? That's the first.
We've got to exercise the community. Which ain't easy.
That community's got to turn away from certain stuff. And, who's standing outside of that community to exercise it? Who's going to call the community accountability? There's got to be some really healthy people. That's why you have so many charismatic leaders sucking people off in weird directions, because charisma itself frequently substitutes for actual health.
What's your answer? You raised the question.
I just think it's enormously complicated, because I think our culture wages war against health. Because health is uneconomical. You don't spend money on pills when you feel healthy. You don't go to the shrink when you feel healthy. I go to a therapist. I wouldn't go to my congregation. My congregation isn't solid enough to help me, my former congregation. And I think most congregations are like that. They attract a lot of wounded people. And the sort of healthy people in the congregation do boundary stuff.
Right.
Just in order not to be destroyed by the congregation. Groups in our culture are very difficult. You're not going to find groups that are all that healthy. It takes so much work. I mean, St. Martin's Table, Holden Village. It takes an enormous amount of energy to keep the boundaries in place so that you don't get destroyed by these people who are seeking authority, seeking transformation. I think this is a very interesting conversation, but sociologically, we can't go back to the 4th century. I don't think sociologically, we're not.
No. But if you're right about the direction of our history as an age, and if you're right, I mean, like, I think that that healthcare will continue to be the privilege of the rich in this society, and will probably be extended in such ways that eventually the church is going to have to raise the question about not only public housing, but also the question about public healing. So that, I don't have an answer for you. I mean, I do have some hope about the future of the church, but I think that the hope of the future of the church sometimes is that things are going to get worse before they get better. And that in the midst of that kind of getting worse, that we as Christians will begin to open our eyes to the possibilities that were always there, mm-hmm. and begin to incorporate them again into our lives. But, and maybe we can even now. I mean, maybe we don't have to wait around. I don't think we do.
A good example would be a place like Holden Village. Do we want to draw lines between Christians and non-Christians? I mean, would that be helpful to folks to say, well, if you don't believe, Jesus is the Son of God, then you're not a Christian. That's okay. Right. Not that you're rejected by God or anything, but you're not a Christian. And those who are Christians believe these various, you do believe some of those things. Well, maybe we should talk about catechumenate then.
Right.
You know, and
right.
kind of draw people to use a common language, because right now, complexity of our culture is that there really is not a common language. If you don't have a common language, you can't talk. There's no community possible.
I wonder too about exorcism, and part of the problem is how we understand evil and how we understand powers, principalities and powers that are at work. It seems to me in our culture right now, everything is simply a chemical imbalance that can be righted with the right kind of chemicals. And
technology.
I mean, I myself have said, I'm not going to cry through a whole other winter. I'm going to go on drugs. I mean, if it takes drugs to live here for the next 4 years, I'll take them. But there is this is the best example I have. A family practice physician is a member of a congregation who sees a number of families in the parish. He knows for generations, actually, at least three generations in the same parish. Sent to me a pastor, a member of this family, sent a member of this family to me because I'm a pastor. And a member of this family came in and said, well, my doctor said that what I need is the forgiveness of sin and really not anything else that he can do for me. So we had this long conversation about the forgiveness of sin, and I said, well, actually, the sin that needs to be forgiven has less to do with me than it has to do with your parents and your older brother. So they march in to the office. And the older brother says, well, the doctor said what I need is antidepressants. So we bring the family physician in. Well, suddenly in this office, we have a pastor, a family physician, a mother, a father, a sister, and an older brother. And there was, I think, a form of exorcism in this
way.
Which was naming the powers of death that were at work in this family.
Right.
The physician saying, almost like the woman with the hemorrhage, I've come to the end of what it is I can offer. Where's the hem of the garment you can reach out and touch? And we met for three times. Now, where is the physician who will not feel that kind of powers? But we ended with a kind of a naming of the powers. These are the powers that are at work dealing death inside this family. What is the release of these powers? Well, for the brother, some of it was medical. Some of it was the way he was self-medicating with alcohol and the way he needed to stop doing that. But some of it was simply the binding up of old things that had not been lucioed, I guess, had just not been unbound in the family. And that was the language we ended up using, was unbinding. What would it take for dad to unbind older brother in such a way that older brother could beg forgiveness from sister for the binding put down on her? I think that was really close to an exorcism.
You bet.
But bringing everybody to a language.
The key was that the power actually was held by the family practice physician. It was he who finally said, and I think this is rare in the medical profession, I'm at the end of what I can do for you.
Right.
You need, because what the sister had come for was med, and he said, I think what you need is the forgiveness of sin. Well, it's interesting because it spilled out into the whole congregation.
So it's delightful to find a good shepherd of health who finally says, I need some other people to help me. I mean, that's a rare thing.
What is interesting, though, is it still was private inside the pastor's study.
Yeah, right.
We did not bring the family forward into the community of faith and say, everyone gathered here now, you who were symbolically at the baptism are now also, you know, sponsors for this healing. How are you going to participate in the healing of this family? And when are you, Bill, going to stop drinking with Joe? Because this is part of the Bible. You know, we couldn't make that step to a more public responsibility because it was still privatized. It was familial in that blood sense rather than in that water sense.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's, I think part of baptism is breaking the back of the idolatry of the familial, the blood family.
Lots of work to be done. lots of stuff to be changed. You something.
It's a mind-blowing story. I know it's not fiction. It ought to be in the New Testament. Next time they reprint that, in the Bible, they'll put that in. I have one question, though. There's one name you didn't mention, and I just wonder, what role did the exorcist, capital T, play in these three sessions? The one who initiated this business about, son, be of good cheer, your sins are forgiven. Either by being named or by somebody being him.
Jesus?
Well,
I think that was my role. I mean, I actually laid on hands in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.
Okay, well, I'm interested in hearing that because I don't think that's insignificant. I'm sure you don't either. It's just that you didn't say so. I just wondered if they finally thought, Pastor Briel is really finally the healer.
No, the reason this family position said good for your pastor was some sense that there was a cure or a name above other names that would have power in the situation.
Well, you're obviously hearing one of the accents I drank, and that is, we all say, you know, the name is important, but I have observed and sometimes done it myself, you know, done great good things for folks, but somehow I forgot to drop the name. And not that the name is magic, but
right.
I'm not finding there in Schrader's name, but somebody else, and I've at least mentioned that he's the one who at least I think is being helpful here.
Right.
We read the story of the woman with the hemorrhage. That's what we read. I don't know how that came to my mind.
Uh-huh.
I guess it was that the physician had said he was at the end of what he knew, and I thought, I know a story about that.
Right.
And the other part of that story is probably, in the Bible, probably true about these folks who had spent all their money on these physicians that still hadn't been healed.
So, I need to finish my story if I can. Is that okay? Wonderful conversation. Exorcism, what do I need to leave? That's a part, I mean, all of this is the same kind of thing, eh? I mean, it's not like separate things. Exorcism, what do I need to give up? And then what do I need to take on? They learned what the Christian life meant in terms of everyday significance. They knew that they were now going to be invited to follow the way that the family had shown them. During the 40 days, there's also a time of teaching. So all of the candidates meet with the parish pastor, or the bishop, as he's called. And there is a period of instruction that happens daily. It's more question and answer, but it is also a part of the process. So for the first part, there is only the scriptures and the Sunday morning. And then during the 40 days, there is some teaching that takes place, but always teaching within the context of what's happening to the candidates. You now know where Lent comes from. It doesn't come because we invented it. It comes because it was the time of preparation of candidates, 40 days before Easter. And it became the pattern of the church's life, that these were the 40 days of preparation. The last 3 days of preparation, prior to, which included Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, were fasting, prayer, and exorcism in even more intensity. Candidates were invited not to fast during that period of time, so that triduum time of those 3 days, which included the passion and death of Jesus, were to be times of getting ready for the baptism. Then the baptism would take place at Easter Vigil. Most of the time there was very little instruction about what would take place. People were assured only that their sponsors would be with them. So they were to experience it first, and then they would learn about it. They were told, "We will be there to help you. You don't have anything to worry about." But usually, Easter Vigil took place on Easter night, and the ceremony begins in the church, and the pastor is leading the ceremony, and one of the elders then takes part of the community off to a place where the baptism will take place. Sometimes this was a baptistry, which would be connected to their house of worship. Sometimes it was living water, a stream that was flowing by. I think they were always warmer than the one out here. But it was a place. And the baptism included the following things. First of all, there had to be a renunciation of sin, death, and the devil. And the renunciation was often about a paragraph long. Not the little phrase that we have in our baptismal service, which nobody really understands. Do you reject the devil and all his works and all his ways? I think it's a powerful statement, but the problem is it's so small that nobody knows what's going on in it. There was a renunciation. The renunciation included facing the West. The West, the place of the rising of the setting sun. The West, the place of darkness. The West, the place of death. The West, which was often where Rome was.
You're not making a contemporary statement that there are about the West.
Not the Northwest.
No, I didn't. I didn't say that. I didn't say that. And you renounced, and with each renunciation, you spit into the West. And so there was this kind of wonderful, the thing that you just sort of, right from the bottom of your lungs, you had to renounce and then spit. Then all your clothes were taken off. After the renunciation, the clothes would be taken off, you would be anointed with oil, and then taken into the water naked. The clothes were never used again. They would be the clothes of former life. You went into the water, you were baptized, Trinitarian formula, creedal statement being used, brought out of the water, again anointed with oil, and then the new vestment was put on you, the white robe of righteousness. We have little fragments of that occasionally in terms of chrismas that we put on babies and so on. We're trying to revive some of the tradition again. Then the candidates would be taken to the church, to the community which was at worship. And it would usually be timed that the community would be at the point almost ready for their first Easter Eucharist. And the candidates were taken in. They knew nothing at all about the Eucharist. They had never attended a Eucharistic service before. Nobody told them about it. It was the mystery. They were also only assured that somehow their sponsors would be with them. And they were then brought before the congregation. The first thing that happened is that the oil of the Spirit and the chrismation of marking them with the sign of the cross took place. Then, following this chrismation, the Eucharistic celebration took place. And for the first time, everything, all these months in which they have been excluded, they are now incorporated. So that on the one hand, they also know what it means to finally be incorporated within the community of Christ. The last days, 50 days usually, were the days in which they then continued to wear the robes, but they continued in their discussion with the community about baptism and about Eucharist. This discussion was also, how does baptism and how does Eucharist, what does the implication of that in terms of my everyday life and about what it will mean for me to be a follower of Jesus? Then, after the 50 days were finished, the robe was washed. I can imagine what the white robe looked like after the 50 days. The robe was washed, and the congregation then prepared for the next group, who would be baptized the next year. What I think is wonderful about this is that it was always seen as the congregation preparing the candidates for baptism and helping the candidates and walking with the candidates. So that the congregation, as it gathers and there is exorcism, must also again ask the question about themselves. The congregation must also again ask the question about what do I need to take put off and what do I need to take on. They all said that it was the candidates of the church, the candidates for baptism, who really created the renewal of the life of the church, so that baptism became a kind of renewal and revival of the life of the church every year. So that was the tradition for the first four centuries, probably starting quite soon after the biblical tradition. Starting, and a pattern then being established. After Christendom takes place, of course, and as more and more people are into forced baptisms, and countries and nations become Christian, the only thing that is really left for people is the baptism of children. So with the baptism of children, and an assumption that we now are living under Christendom, where all of the teachings of the church are being flourished throughout the whole of the land, then that whole idea of somehow preparing people for baptism was just never done. Now we face the kind of question again, we live in this secular age, about whether this ancient rite and these ancient traditions are not the traditions that will help us again today. Tomorrow, I want to talk a little bit about how the ancient traditions have been brought into the 20th century and what we're doing with the ancient traditions and how we are trying to use them within congregations today. And this is not just a Lutheran's agenda, this is an ecumenical agenda. And it is an agenda which we are really, although we had to form our program alone, we didn't form it alone. We used the work that other people were doing and see ourselves within a kind of ecumenical context as we try to look at the question about adults who are being brought to baptism. Raising this question also then brought about the question of affirmation of baptism, because there are many adults who've been baptized when they were children and at some point in their life fled the church or were excommunicated from the church by their parents or were excommunicated by the church by their culture, namely that the baseball took over or hockey took over or something else took over. And what do we then do with those who have already been in the covenant of baptism but are now finding their way back within the life of the church? And is it possible that somehow some of the same tradition can be now used to reincorporate or to help these people to understand that which happened to them a long time ago? So we have said, no, this program is not only for the baptized, those to be baptized. This program needs to also be for those who are affirming and wish to affirm their baptism and reaffirm their life in Christ. As we developed this program, the other thing that we began to think about is the baptism of infants. And we certainly don't give up the tradition in any way, and certainly do not continue to believe that somehow this tradition is an important tradition in the life of the church. But how do we escape the concept that somehow I need to just come in and get my kid done? So we began to think about the baptism of children, and then the process needing to be an education of parents rather than of children, but that some of the same kind of process needs to take place within the life of a family who are bringing their child to baptism.